Welcome, everyone, to the Council on Foreign Relations Asia Unbound podcast series. I'm Liz Economy, and this week I'm delighted to welcome Joshua Kurlansik. Josh is a senior fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of a provocative new book, State Capitalism: How the Return of Statism is Transforming the World. Welcome, Josh, and congratulations on your new book.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the big question. What is state capitalism, and why should we care about it?
Okay, well, state capitalism can mean a lot of different things in terms of how a government wields influence over an economy. But the book is about a new era of state capitalism in which a certain handful of countries wield control over 30 to 40% of the largest companies in their countries. And at the same time, a number of these countries are China, Brazil, Malaysia, Thailand, are becoming increasingly influential strategically. So in the book, I look at why state capitalism, which seemed like it had gone out of vogue 20 or 30 years ago, has returned, whether it has a real long-term future and its influence on politics and the strategic environment. And why we should care is, well, first of all, quite a few of these countries are pretty important to the world economy. So if the economic model that they're using is working, that's great. If it's failing, like in Brazil and perhaps to some extent in China, that's a serious problem, not only for them, but for everyone. Secondly, there's a lot of question about whether this economic model is corrosive to democratic institutions, either in countries like Brazil or Thailand that have already tried to make a transition to democracy, or is it hindering any sort of transition to freer politics in a place like China or Vietnam, et cetera.
So one of the important points that you make, which I think you're just starting to allude to, is that there is no one-size-fits-all for state capitalism. What are the differences among, some of the differences among the states that you look at, a Brazil as opposed to a China as opposed to a Singapore?
Right, well, there's two different things I think are interesting that I point out in the book. One is, in terms of the differences, it is possible to have an economy where the government controls at least 30% of the largest companies and still be highly integrated with the world, relatively transparent, and have sustained long-term growth. It doesn't mean that this has happened a lot, but it has happened. It's happened in Singapore, and probably the best example is Norway. On the other hand, you have a whole spectrum running through the middle where you have countries with a high degree of state control of corporations where they have managed to pull off pretty impressive growth for a long period of time, but now you're starting to see the cracks and fissures like in China and Vietnam. And then you go all the way to a country where the state control of the economy has just been an utter looting, and where this looting is stifling entrepreneurship and totally undermining the future, and that is a place like Russia, for example. The second distinction that's interesting, I think, is that in terms of stability in the international system and as strategic partners in the United States, it's really about what the type of government is that's running these state capitalist nations. And so I don't think there should be an overall fear of state control of a certain number of companies in terms of U.S. strategic interests. We have quite a few of these countries that, if they're democratically governed, are no different to work with than a country that is more free market capitalist. It's how the country is governed. So these authoritarian state capitalists tend to be much more likely to utilize state companies as weapons, whereas you don't see that being done by Norway or Singapore or even larger state capitalists like Brazil.
Okay, so in that picture that you paint, then, one would assume that countries like China and Vietnam might use their companies and that power over their companies as weapons. Have you seen examples of this?
Sure. Well, I mean, the three most obvious countries that are using state companies as weapons, which is the most disturbing aspect of this growth in state capitalism, is China, Russia, and Vietnam. So Russia has repeatedly utilized Gazprom as to try to punish countries in Central and Eastern Europe when it's had actual military conflicts with them, like Georgia. Gazprom becomes another weapon utilized, or when there's diplomatic tensions, Gazprom has become a weapon to try to utilize. China and Vietnam have, on several occasions, attempted to utilize or have utilized the companies in a way that really wouldn't be feasible with a private company utilizing them as a weapon of the state. So when China moved in 2014, when the rig was moved into disputed waters in the South China Sea, I think that, you know, from if that was a private, I mean, a publicly held or even a privately held, but an actual non-state company, I don't think that moving a rig into disputed waters in the South China Sea with a high degree of uncertainty and unclear economic potential underneath would have been a decision taken by management. I think that was a decision that was taken because it was a Chinese state company. It was being utilized in a way that was not profit-seeking. That's the most obvious example, but Vietnam has also used Petro-Vietnam at times in ways to state claims that, again, it would be hard to justify those actions if you were your sole motivation was seeking profit.
Okay, but is this any different in substantive way from, you know, a democratically governed country and a free market country using sanctions, right? I mean, it's just a different kind of economic weapon.
Well, I mean, there are lots of different weapons that can be utilized. I think that, sure, I mean, there you can utilize weapons, but if the United States government, first of all, I don't think this would be possible because it would be disastrous to the United States economy, but if in addition to the sanctions that could be applied by the United States government, either limited sanctions or broader economic sanctions, many of which haven't been effective, but if in addition to that, the United States government could, in dealing with countries with which we have diplomatic and economic ties, decide at times to withhold or change the course of, and totally change the course of investment of major companies, or that would be an enormous weapon of influence. Sanctions are a much broader tool than what I'm referring to here. But also, the book discusses the second part of why this utilization of state companies is problematic is it crowds out the entrepreneurship of truly private, or it could be publicly held, but truly free market companies within these countries themselves. And in the long term, that's also highly problematic. So that's most noticeable in Russia, where the state uses its state companies to crush any companies that are not state held in the same industries. It's noticeable in China. It's noticeable in Vietnam. So there's both a international strategic rationale and an economic rationale for why that we should be concerned about this new state capitalism.
Okay, so you mentioned China, and you spend a fair amount of time in the book focused on China. And I think overall your take on the country's economic future, the way that the leadership has managed the process of economic development, is a fairly positive one. But over the past year, of course, we've seen that China has encountered a number of bumps in its efforts to reform its economy. I'm wondering how that shapes your perspective on sort of China as a model of state capitalism.
Well, I would say it's more mixed, my view. My view is that one of the things that state capitalism can do early in a trajectory of development that Singapore did really well, for example, was they used the state's funding to allocate capital in industries that can be critical to boosting growth at the beginning, provide a lot of jobs, and also possibly where capital markets are shallow. And I think China did some of those things well. And I think that what's positive in the book is, looking back, I think that the book also talks about going forward, a view shared by, I think, a lot of true China economists, that they've reached the limits of what this model, which I do give them credit for, has attained. And it's not just cracks and fissures, but a dramatic shift needs to be made to a model that reduces the reliance on some of these tools of stoking the economy that I do think were effective, and allows the private sector, which is now makes up the vast majority of job-creating companies, more freedom to operate. So I wouldn't say it's not, I would say it's positive about what's already happened and very worried about where it goes from here.
So do you see the potential for China to transform into that more attractive model of, say, Singapore?
I think that the potential is there. I think that people who believe that if they don't make that transition, it's going to be a disaster for China's economy and for the world economy are correct. But I don't think that I think it's possible. And I'm sorry to say that I think it's possible even under a highly authoritarian regime. When that doesn't make me feel great about saying that, and it doesn't mean that I think in the long term political change needs to happen too, but I don't think that it's necessarily true that just because an authoritarian regime, a highly authoritarian regime, a more authoritarian regime than the previous government in power, those transitions can't be made. I'm not seeing evidence that they are, but Singapore made the transition when there was still a highly authoritarian regime in government.
So are there any steps that we should be looking for with regard to China that would suggest that it's making that transition now successfully?
I mean, on the international stage, I think that we should be looking to see whether in some of these flashpoints, state companies are again being used as weapons. And also, I think that on the domestic stage, we should be looking to see whether any of the plans to actually reduce the size of the state companies in the sectors deemed strategic are actually happening, and what the ratio of bank lending is in terms of how what percentage is being given out to private companies. If you're asking me about signs about whether the government is going to change, I mean, you know that better than I. I could tell you all the signs, but that they're all going in the other direction.
Right. No, that's right.
I could tell you what the signs would be. No, there would be at least a return to some acceptance of public critique and some degree of investigation by major media outlets of financial transparency, et cetera. But my point is simply that I think that it's possible. I don't necessarily think that the two reforms in the beginning have to go hand in hand. That's not been the experience in a lot of other East Asian countries. That's all.
Okay. So, you know, we've become very cognizant of the winners and losers in more free market economies, and you've suggested that one of the challenges in the state capitalism model is that sometimes entrepreneurship can get crowded out. Are there other losers, and who are the winners in this model within the countries?
Well, in a good scenario, it would be possible to have the winners be average citizens. But let's look at the most extreme example, Norway, but even in Singapore too, where the state did a pretty good job of putting initial capital into a number of industries and helping them grow, kind of acting like an angel investor, because it's a small country and people at the time when Singapore essentially divorced from Malaysia, there were a lot of international investors who didn't even think Singapore survived. So the state played a role, but at the same time, it kept a high degree of oversight and good corporate governance in most state companies, and that'd be true in Norway. So citizens benefit in that it has boosted the economy, but it hasn't created a class of rentier elites, and it's also state companies are not crowding out small companies, they're not crowding out entrepreneurship. Who doesn't benefit in countries where there isn't effective, and I mean, we could go into great detail, but in the book I talk about the ways in which Norway, for example, has made the governance of state companies as good quality as a publicly traded multinational. In a country where state companies are not well governed, those who do not benefit are not just entrepreneurs, but it could be anyone who needs a loan for anything, and loan capital is being gobbled up. It could be not just entrepreneurs, but the overall economic system, anyone who benefits or doesn't benefit from the general economic system and the general job creation when jobs are being dominated, when the market is being dominated by a few small companies, who does benefit. So, for example, in Russia, who benefits is a small group of people, usually with links to the vague or otherwise links to the Kremlin. In Thailand, who benefits from the companies, it tends to be people with links to now the military in the past or other military elites. So the beneficiaries of a poorly managed state capitalism tend to be a small group of sort of rentier elites.
Now, looking ahead, countries such as Vietnam, Malaysia, and Singapore have all signed on to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And there are elements of that agreement that would suggest that the role of the state is going to need to be reduced. Do you think that this kind of international trade agreement can have an important impact in shaping how these state capitalist countries evolve?
Yes, definitely, no doubt. But those three countries are at. So let's just maybe get back one step. So it's not going to be a big problem for Singapore. Singapore's already, one of the interesting things is the state has control over a certain number of companies, but they force those companies to also compete both with local and international companies. And Singapore has no agricultural sector and is already party to many, many trade deals. So TPP is not a huge hurdle for them. But the others, the Vietnamese government, I mean, no one can say for sure that this is what they're doing because it's an even more opaque system than China. But good money has it that people in the Vietnamese government who would like to reduce the influence of state companies and shift the balance of the economy somewhat believe that the TPP will force the Vietnamese economy to make that move. And then by signing up to the TPP, which all studies show would be a huge boon for Vietnam's economy, Vietnamese leaders can use that and then also, in a way, scapegoat it and say, well, we signed this agreement, it's going to be good for us, but we have to make these reforms. I didn't decide we were going to make this part of the agreement. And that, I think that was a major rationale for signing up. It's a tool of leverage. And I think if the TPP passes and Vietnam succeeds and the deal is passed, it will have a significantly positive effect on Vietnam's economy. And I think there is reason to believe from the Vietnamese government's past behavior that they are serious about that. So the third category is Malaysia. Singapore is not a problem. I think they just signed up because they generally support free trade, and this is free trade coming at a higher level and of a higher standard. Vietnam is a pretty closed economy, but this is a potential opportunity to significantly open it up. Malaysia, it's unclear. Maybe the Malaysian government signed up because for good reasons. Maybe they signed up because they want to be seen as a closer strategic partner in the United States. There is very, very weak public support for the TPP in Malaysia. There's huge entrenched state companies that have important powers in political elections, and I'm not sure whether the TPP can pass and Malaysia can also fulfill its promises under the TPP. So when the rubber hits the road, I'm not sure that the Malaysian government is going to be willing to make the concessions needed under the agreement.
Okay, so one last question. Again, I think throughout the book, you do a great job of distinguishing among the different kinds of state capitalism and what those different kinds of state capitalist countries mean for the United States. But is there anything sort of writ large that you think the United States can learn from these countries? Is there something that the U.S. should be doing differently looking at the different kinds of models that you present?
Well, sure. I mean, I never in any of my work, this book or the previous book about democracy, I never take the view that any U.S. model is necessarily the one to strive for, because I think that it's often true that there are many models that are more effective, and then the United States today has some very significant economic and political challenges. I think that one of the things that some of these more effective state capitalists have done well is they have taken some of the state funds and marked it aside for important infrastructural developments that they can see ahead are going to be critical to the economic needs of the future. And one of the points I make in the book is obviously some of these countries like Singapore, they were able to make major infrastructural investments like high-speed broadband and a much more expanded metro and an expansion of their port because although Singapore is not an authoritarian state today, it's a kind of hybrid state, and the political process is very streamlined. But still, looking ahead and taking a hard look at where the state money needs to be spent on infrastructure going ahead is something the United States could desperately use to do. I'm certainly not the first person to say that. So that's one. The second is that the standards of governance of state companies in these more effective state capitalists like Singapore and Norway is very impressive. And like in Norway, for example, all of the Statoil, the biggest, the state oil company, everything, every meeting, every major decision, minutes of it are published online. And I think that that level of governance is actually higher than many multinationals. But yeah, there are many things that can be learned. I mean, the book talks more about for the U.S.'s strategic interest, but I think certainly a number of these state companies have prioritized infrastructure spending in a way that, sadly, in the United States, I don't think we really have.
Great. Well, thanks so much. I think the book is fascinating. You know, it's well argued, and it's certainly very timely. So thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Thanks.